and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield. This is a podcast about our deepest values, about where we find meaning and how we can build curiosity and empathy across our very many divides. Every week, I speak to someone who has some kind of public voice or platform about what is sacred to them. I ask them to reflect deeply about the work that they do and how it aligns with their values. And I try and listen deeply, try and understand what makes them tick. I speak to people from all across the different spectrums on which we all sit. Religious and non-religious, political, the 9,000 other things that we find to disagree on. And my hope is that these conversations broaden our horizons outside our own little tribe and our echo chamber, and that they carve out a little bit of space for depth in a shallow and fast-moving world. In this episode, you will hear a conversation I had with Dugald Hine. Dugald started life as a BBC producer, has run startups and social enterprises, and with Paul Kingsnorth started the Dark Mountain Project. He has been writing and communicating over decades, primarily around and about climate change. And his first book, At Work in the Ruins, explores a question that I think many of us ask privately and can be very explosive to ask publicly. What if our sense that the world is getting worse is accurate? What if we really can't halt runaway climate change and the future is going to look unimaginably different from the present? It's a big and often scary question, but I think an important one. And Dougal's perspective is pretty direct about the depth of the trouble that he thinks we are in, all of us are in. And I'm aware that listeners may not agree with him, and that is absolutely fine. Part of the point of this podcast is to listen to voices that we do not agree with. But wherever you sit on agreeing or disagreeing with him, I would I'd encourage you to listen anyway, even if listening to someone from that perspective sounds like it might be very heavy. Because the subject matter is heavy, but I have found Dougal's work and this conversation that I had with him to be, yes, bracing, but also quite centering and steadying, strangely, humane and thoughtful. There'll be some reflections at the end, as usual, from me. But in the meantime, I hope you enjoy listening. Dougald, we are going to go straight in the deep end. And I am going to ask you what is sacred to you. What bubbled up, having had some time to reflect on this non-standard opening question?
Well, I remember listening to an episode of your podcast, Liz, when you had my old friend Mary Harrington on here. And you asked her this question, and she came back with a characteristically incisive response of how, you know, you couldn't have personal sacred values because sacred values are precisely what emerges from a society, a community, a way of being human together. I remember thinking it was a very thoughtful response. And also that it was totally different to what the word conjured up for me, because for me, the language of the sacred points to something beyond. You know, religion or spirituality can start out pointing towards something that humans come together and do. But when I've ever used the language of the sacred, it's been to point towards something that lies beyond the edge of that. A sort of encounter where, you know, as a writer, you're in the place where words start to fail. And so if I ask myself what is sacred to me, in a sense, it's that. It's, you know, what would I, you know, what's not for sale in me is the conviction that there is something more than appears to be the case. There is something more than we are told is the case. That there's more to us as humans than the story that we mostly absorb from the kind of societies that most of us have grown up in. That there are experiences, whether it's kind of out in wilderness, or whether it's just a small moment of kindness witnessed, or whether it's ways of coming together around a kitchen table that make room for or bring us into awareness of there being something that's missing from the story the market tells us, or the story the state tells us, or the story that science tells us often about what kinds of things we are and what kind of world we're in. So I guess that's what's sacred to me. And I can feel, even as I'm saying it, that I'm proving this thing about the limits of language, or it being the kind of the place at which words start to fail us.
Yeah, which is a, I think, helpfully humbling place to start a conversation, and I'm sure we'll come back to humbling. But do you have a sense of times in your life where the fact that that thing is sacred to you, that the image that's coming to mind as you speak so beautifully is like something glimpsed out of the corner of an eye that if we turn and look straight on, we can't see, but nevertheless is vital that we hold it in the corner of our vision as we orient ourselves. What have you made decisions, or can you think of times where following that thread has guided you?
I think that at a very kind of gut level, there have been times in my life where I've not done the sensible thing, where I've not done the thing that makes sense according to any kind of explicit logic that is there in the world and the society that I grew up in, because there was some kind of pull, some kind of tug. And the time that I've spoken about on various occasions is being 25 and having been working at the BBC for a year on short-term contracts as a radio journalist. And I get offered a staff job, and it's going to be internal applicants only, and I'm the only person with the experience and qualifications. So I'm basically being given a clear run at this, you know, very secure foot on the career ladder. And the same day, like 12 hours later, my phone rings as I'm on my way home at the end of a late shift. And it's my oldest friend saying, you know, you always said if the spare room in our house came free, then give you first refusal on it. Well, my housemate's done a bunk and she hasn't been paying the rent, and our landlord's given us a fortnight to find someone else. Do you want to move to London? And there was no sensible basis on which I, pursuing the second of those options that were kind of laid before me that day, was the right thing to do. But there was some kind of tug at the heart and the guts, and something that said, you know, steer this way and you're steering towards coming alive. And I don't think I could have expressed it like that then, but that's sort of the language that I found myself using, and I've heard echoed from various other people in the years since about those moments. So that's, you know, that doesn't feel like a very costly example when I think about the situations in which the, you know, what's sacred to us is really put to the choice. I hope that if I found myself in a costlier situation, I hope I would be as quick to follow that thread, that pull, rather than to do the sensible thing, the thing that's expected. But those are the kind of ways in which it shows up as part of the pattern of life for me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been really helpful diving into your story and noticing the so much of your work is about the stories that we tell and where they're helpful and not helpful. And I have been seeing echoes in my own life of the story that is up and to the right. The right choice is always bigger, faster, stronger, more money and more status. And I sometimes get a bit freaked out that I feel like my life has been downwardly mobile, you know, starting from a similar point at the BBC and continually taking steps away from established paths. But yes, that kind of inner orientation of what are our values and therefore what is the kind of life that we need to be leading and how do we have the courage to follow it is very present. But before we get more into your story, I want to dive back into your childhood to get a sense of what were the ideas that shaped you, that maybe shaped this sense of the sacred. What were the big ideas in the air? Just paint a word picture. Where did you grow up and what were the big ideas around
you? Well, I mean, you could probably attribute a lot of it to having spent the first 3 years of my life in the grounds of a theological college in Cambridge. My dad spent 35 years as a United Reformed Church minister, and I was born while he was training for the ministry. And so, you know, I grew up, the way I always say it is I grew up around churches, and I grew up sort of taking for granted almost that I had two worlds. I had the school world and then the church world, and in both I had sets of friends. And you know, in the church world, there were you know, people older and younger than me who I knew better, whereas at school, you were kind of squashed together with a bunch of people exactly the same age. And it was a bit like, you know, actually both sides of it, both the very early childhood that I hardly remember of growing up in the grounds of the theological college, we were in this sort of two-room converted boat shed, but you tumble out of the front door as a toddler and be out onto the lawn and all of the grown-ups there knew you and knew you, your parents. It was sort of village childhood. And then I realized as I'm saying this, that in another sense, that kind of growing up in church with lots of kind of surrogate aunts and uncles and grandparents effectively was a kind of quality of village upbringing that, in hindsight, it was quite rare for someone born in our generation in a Western country. But I think there was always also, from quite early on, a sense of this is going away. Like, you know, as I got into my teens, certainly a sense that my dad was kind of ministering to the last generation who had grown up with this as part of a memory of this as part of the background fabric of a country like England. And that it wasn't going to last much longer in that form. And you know, it wasn't there as a kind of going concern, as a live proposition. Certainly by the time I became a parent, I can't just wander into a church near where we live here in Sweden and find something that would be for my son what growing up around church was for me. And that's before you get to, like, you asked about big ideas, and I started telling you about, like, actually the kind of the context, the culture, the everyday of it. But that was it, that, you know, there were ideas or stories kind of permeating the background of that. And I realize now in my 40s how shaped my imagination must have been by the kind of language of the Bible and prayer. But it wasn't a kind of countercultural experience of religion in opposition to the world around it. It was a very ordinary, kind of humble culture of, you know, being in service and community. And I think if you grow up, like, if you grow up with a parent who's a minister or a priest or whatever, it can sort of go one of two ways. You either kind of, I've definitely known people who saw a hypocrisy or a gap between the public and the personal experience, and, you know, who were alienated from church by that. And that was never my experience. I always, you know, had a respect for what I saw my dad and others within the church doing at the level of just, you know, taking care and being there for people. But the big ideas weren't necessarily in the foreground. You could get into those conversations if you wanted to. But that's not the thing that sticks out in my memory of that way of growing up.
And how did you personally, what was your personal kind of orientation, posture? I'm trying to avoid all the kind of Christianese, like, what was your relationship with God? You know, what was the texture of your connection with your parents' faith, I guess?
I don't know. I remember being like maybe 11 or 12 and a conversation with a Sunday school teacher where I was like, I don't find the concept of hell particularly helpful, which is a fairly precocious thing to say in hindsight. And I remember the utter incomprehension, like just the kind of falling down a gap between us of this conversation, because it was like, you know, the idea that hell was, might be thought of as a concept or that it might be intended to be helpful didn't really kind of compute, let's say. And there were gaps, there were differences between what was going on upstairs and downstairs in this particular church where I was growing up, where there were some more kind of fundamentalist strains of Christianity around and the youth leadership, where it just sort of seemed absurd to me to be expected to make a choice between what we were being taught about the history of the earth in science at school and the interpretations of the Bible that some of the Sunday school teachers were attached to. So, but I guess I kind of then grew up and went out into the world with a sort of lingering, slightly dutiful attachment or sense that I ought to have an attachment to the church. And through my 20s, I was still drifting between different churches and attending without finding my place particularly. And then somewhere along the way, I had a sort of experience of being released from that, of, you know, not needing to try anymore. And I remember I was sitting in Sheffield Cathedral on, it must have been Evensong on Easter Day, and I would have been around 30, a year or so on one side or the other. And having this sense, the only way that I could explain it was suddenly feeling like I'm listening to a joke that has been being retold so many times that everyone's forgotten that this bit is meant to be the punchline. And in the same experience or somewhere around the same moment, it being a threshold of just no longer needing to try and make this part of my identity or something I needed to talk about publicly, and being able to just go off and see where I found myself and where I was led. And that was kind of, I think that letting go of some kind of dutiful kind of feeling that I ought to be better at, keeping this thing going that felt like it was dying in the form that I had been brought up in it. There was a definite release at that stage.
Do you think that dutifulness came out of love for your dad? Was how much of it was that you wanted to?
I don't think it was that, especially. It wasn't that I was pretending to have a faith that I didn't have exactly. Though it might be that the sort of the vessel of the words and forms and rituals and so on, I wasn't sure how much of that was real to me. But the sense of connection to something that had always been there through this growing up, and for want of a better word, I would use the language of God to talk about that experience. That never went away, but I no longer felt any obligation to be able to talk about that or to try and belong somewhere where I didn't really know how to belong.
Yeah, we're back to the limits of language. That seems like sort of pleasingly peaceful certainly transition point compared to many that I've heard. Alongside that journey in your 20s, you'd left this kind of broadcast journalist pathway at the BBC. And then there was a season where building community and thinking about space and how on quite a local level we structure our lives became a real focus of yours. Could you say a little bit about that season?
Yeah. I mean, I guess what sort of happened was because I had walked away from what looked like the beginnings of a career at the BBC, I actually went back off and on and worked as a casual reporter in newsrooms for a few more years. But I'd made it clear to myself and everyone else that I was not committed to the path of the career there. And quite quickly after that, found myself like in that first year when I turned down the job and moved in with Billy in London, that I found myself working in warehouses and call centers and, just this very humbling experience of having come through a very good education and always been kind of ticking all the right boxes and suddenly finding that you've fallen out of that reality. And needing to find things that mattered and made sense to me and that helped me find my bearings and sort of needing to find, well, what's actually worth doing with a life? And just going around looking for spaces that felt alive. And I remember like there was a hacker space in Sheffield called Access Space where they were reusing like old computers that people were throwing away and free open source software. And I kind of wandered in there one day and felt something and got drawn back and hung out there a lot. And I got involved with various kinds of activism and found various thinkers who were helping me make sense of things, whether it was Ivan Illich or John Berger or Alistair McIntosh. His book, Soil and Soul, meant a lot to me. And, all of this was kind of leading towards trying to learn how you create a different story, how you invite people into a different story, a different way of being together that makes room for parts of ourselves that, aren't welcome or that it wouldn't be wise to bring to lots of the jobs and workplaces and schools and, even families that we've kind of grown up in. And one of the ways that I ended up starting to put that into practice was there was this email newsletter called Pick Me Up that my friend Charlie had started. And he'd been the last features editor at The Face magazine. And, they used to do stories about activism and about kind of cultural, people trying to make things happen. And so he tried to carry that on, or did carry that on, in the form of this newsletter that came out every Friday afternoon. And he had a couple of rules for how you told stories when you were writing for this. And I learned a huge amount from working with him. And one was you couldn't sort of be a journalist and go along and sort of observe some other people doing something and then write about it. You had to get involved in whatever way you could and help, and then tell the story of what you learned through that experience. And then the other one was when you told that story, you weren't allowed to tell it in a story that would make people go, oh, I wish I could do that. You had to show your foolishness. You had to show your mistakes, the ways that you'd been kind of having to make it up as you went along so that the reader would go, oh, I could do that. And so a few years after that, with some of the people I'd met through that, firstly, we had this internet startup that was a bit of a disaster, really, that was kind of inspired by Illich's de-schooling society and trying to create ways of matching up people to organize their own learning outside of institutions. But then I started this meetup called Spacemakers, which was for anyone who was interested in reimagining the spaces that are they're sitting empty or underused or overlooked within cities. And we started doing things like from the meetup grew into an agency, and we started doing things like taking over a bunch of empty shops and filling them with new projects and little startup businesses and so on. And then we created this community owned and run street market in West Norwood in South London. And that was the project that really, it felt to me like it embodied some of what I was reaching for at that point in time, because it was this, it's still going. like 12 or 13 years later, the street market that happens once a month on a Sunday up and down the town centre of West Norwood. And it's all kind of, from the beginning, run by volunteers, like local people who got involved in making it happen. And we, as Spacemakers, helped the first year or two design it and get it off the ground. And I remember looking, there was a photograph that someone took of these volunteers at about 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning on the steps outside the parish church in the middle of West Norwood, waiting for a van where they're going to be setting up market stalls up and down that part of the high street. And I remember thinking, like, maybe these people always secretly had a desire to run a street market, but I don't think that's why they're getting out of bed at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning when they've had their working week already. I think it's that the street market is an excuse for something else, something that can come into play when we come together to make things happen for our own reasons in ways that aren't dominated by the logic of, well, obviously I'm doing this because someone's paying me, or obviously I'm doing this because someone's told me and they have power over me, they can tell me that I have to go to school or whatever. And that, you know, this is back to what I was trying to describe when you asked me about what's sacred to me, that there is something that comes out to play, something that comes into the space when we come together for reasons that don't fit with those logics, the logic of the market or the state. And part of the reason why I was doing this, part of the reason why I was stumbling around, bringing people together, trying to learn how to make things happen in this way, was a conviction that, you know, things are going to get harder and, you know, things are going to go on falling apart in a lot of ways in our societies on the trajectory we're headed into. And how well or how badly that plays out will have something to do with the extent to which we can remember, recover the capacity of coming together to do things for reasons other than because we're being paid to or being told to. That in some strange sense, that I didn't try and explain to many of the people who I was working with or who were getting involved in these projects, but that nonetheless, we were kind of rehearsing for being able to come together and make life work under difficult circumstances through these, you know, quite local, quite small scale projects that I was part of creating at that time in my life.
Yeah.
I want you to say a little bit more about that trajectory and knowing how to do that with care, given that listeners will be in really different places around what climate change, but also a lot of other kind of unspooling crises in our world are meaning, is a tricky one, because I know that when we hear things that make us feel afraid, we go into fight, flight, freeze, which will basically, if we don't take care here, you and me, Dougald, then no one's going to hear the entire rest of the conversation. Because I know this, I get to a place in conversations where the depth of the trouble that we're in, as you put it in your book, comes out of the box in my head where I'm trying to keep it. And I look it in the face, and there is just a sort of emotional firestorm then that can set off. What is so helpful about your book is the way that it doesn't leave you there. And I've heard you talk about some of the ways we think about the future and the future we were expecting versus the future we might actually get is around the stages of grief and these kind of non-linear processes. So I wonder if a helpful thing might be for you to talk through your own, you know, what led from kind of environmental activism to Dark Mountain as a way of processing how you've got to a sense of the falling apart trajectory that we're on and how you've learned to sit with it.
Yeah. I mean, when I look back, I feel in a way, getting involved with climate activism in particular and environmental activism in my late 20s, part of what was going on for me in that, I mean, I definitely had this kind of moment of, I call it in the book, an oh fuck moment, like kind of crossing a threshold where you go from being vaguely aware of climate change as something that's sort of hanging out on the edge of your field of vision on the list of all of the things that you know, yeah, that might make up the trouble that the world is in, to it being the thing that is keeping you awake at night. And I was still doing some shifts at Radio Sheffield at the time. And I remember kind of climbing around on desks, switching off the monitors that my colleagues had left on when they had gone home, you know, recycling as if it's going to make everything okay. And that sort of, it's almost like you get hit by that and you go through a season in which you're kind of frantically trying to keep up some secret deal with the universe, where if I do all of this stuff...
It's bargaining. You're trying to bargain your way out of this.
Exactly. And then somewhere further down the line, you go across another line where you go, oh gosh, I might change all the light bulbs that my arm can reach and like, persuade all of my friends to stop flying and the rest of it. And it might still not be enough. And at that point, you're kind of having... You're hitting a confrontation with an enormity. And this is where I actually think that it might be helpful to bring this stuff closer to this, you know, to the way I was talking about the sacred at the beginning, like the encounter with something vastly larger and other than us. And this is the kind of inkling that I've had lately that part of what happens around climate change is that for those of us who, have at least one side of ourselves that has been kind of schooled in and initiated into this modern way of being in the world in which science is the thing that has the authority to tell us what is real and true and all of that. Climate change is the place where that side of ourselves gets given the permission to experience the sense of living in a time of endings. And I say it like that not because I'm particularly wanting to question the veracity of what science has to tell us about how deep the trouble we're in is, but because I think that often there are other sides to the trouble we're in. I say it in the book, if the IPCC were to turn around tomorrow and say, guys, it's terribly embarrassing. Turns out we did our sums wrong. You can put out all the CO2 you want. It's not going to change the climate system and the atmospheric chemistry after all. Like, I don't think many of us who are in any way kind of alive or awake to, or just kind of even keeping in a box in the corner of ourselves, this sense of the trouble that we're in with climate change, I don't think many of us really believe that if that happened, everything would be okay. I think it's more that climate change is the place where the news about the trouble we're in is brought to us with the stamp of the authority of science. And therefore we get permission, the modern parts of ourselves get permission to experience this sense of living at a time of being called deeply into question, a time where we can't go on like this. And I can think of people I talk to who are totally alienated from science and don't actually, you know, aren't really willing to consider that climate change is happening, or at least that it's caused by humans, or at least that it's a problem, but who for other reasons have been brought to that sense of things can't go on like this. We're deep in trouble. We're in a time of endings. And I think part of what I've tried to do with the book is actually to build some bridges where we can meet around that deeper sense. There's a guy whose work I found while I was writing the book, Federico Campagna, who has this thing where he says, you know, sometimes you're born into the ending of a world. This is a thing that happens. It's happened before in other times and places. And I think for me, there's something quieting and something helpful about that in contrast to the kind of, everything is staked on what we do in the next few years, which is often the tone of voice we move into when we start to talk about climate change. So sometimes you're born into a time of endings. And what Federico says is, how do you recognize this? You recognize it because the future doesn't work anymore. Because the future in the ordinary sense of the word is a kind of projection that's made from the recent past through the present onwards, offering a trajectory of promise or hope, or at least sense of security, of continuity. And if you've been born into the ending of a world, then you're at the end of the story, the narrative arc of that world. And when people try to talk about the future, when they appeal to the future in that way, it doesn't sound convincing anymore. And I think we can kind of see how this has been playing out politically over the last 10 years or more, that there's a lot of potency in reaching towards the past, in invoking the past just now. I think of Anthony Barnett saying about Brexit and the election of Donald Trump. And he's like, you know, those slogans, make America great again, take back control. The two most important words there are again and back. It's this potency of, you know, gesturing towards the past rather than the future, which is, you know, which is true in a certain sense to the kind of moment we're in, even if the ways that that then gets used might not be helpful and might lead in directions that we would want to resist. So then, like, Campagna's thing is, so if you're in a time where you recognize that the world into which you were born is coming to an end, then maybe the moves that are worth trying are, like, to stop worrying as much about making sense according to the logic of the world that is ending, and to start trying to make good ruins. Because, you know, there's going to be people around and there's going to be work to be done through and on the far side of whatever it is that's ending. And whatever it is that's ending is going to leave things behind out of which people are going to have to make ways of living, make lives worth living under the circumstances that we find ourselves in. And so rather than, you know, maybe this is how come you and I both find ourselves on this kind of the downwardly mobile trajectory, is because in some sense, this kind of call that's hard to put words to can be a call to worry less about succeeding within the logics of the world that is ending and attend more to what's going to be around for those who are realizing in one sense or another that something is ending, and nonetheless that we're still here and we're going to still be here and we're going to have to find ways of making life works.
It feels like the phrase that comes to mind sometimes when I'm talking to people about the work that my little micro community is doing is about building the ark and, or yeah, becoming the kind of people that are needed at the end of the world, is the phrase I've been using for about the last 5 years. And it is a real kind of repeated process, almost a liturgical process for me, of coming to awareness of the trouble that we're in, going into panic, going into fight, freeze, going into, this is the only world I've ever known. What will the world be like for my kids? What have we done? Like, grief and horror. And then having to go, knowing I can't live there, and knowing that if I just go back into denial and numbness, I'll just ping between those two states forever. And so for me, drawing on my tradition, which I wanted to talk to you about this as someone who was raised with the stories of the Bible and stuff, This new sense of, I'm a Christian, that there should be things in these stories that mean this is less of a shock, right? That if I had fully inhabited the narrative world of the scriptures strongly enough for it to form me more than the countervailing force of the culture of what you call modernity, Paul Kingsmore calls the machine, you know, other people have used different language for, then the idea that the world was always going to end, or the world as we knew it that was always going to end, should be less of a shock. And that turbulence, challenge, much being asked of us is the thing, that the phrase that's going around in my head a lot at the moment. Much will be asked of us, and too little has been asked of us around here lately, like in recent years. Be hot, make money, do your job well. It's not a high calling, right? Like, much will be asked of us, and that might be good as well as bad. That my tradition, which says, yes, grieve, yes, lament, yes, get angry, do not be afraid. Like, lean into love. Lean into each other, love your neighbor, should and sort of is now when I let it take up the space it needs to in order to do that, should be this source of kind of steadying, a steadying story, a steadying posture. What have you found? One, I'd love to just hear your thoughts on that. And two, what have you found to help you go through those, the emotional and narrative shift that you're arguing so clearly in the book we need to do?
Well, thinking about the experience that Paul Kingsnorth and I had when we started Dark Mountain, part of what I saw happening there, like firstly, the two of us met around, you know, a common sense of disillusionment with the way in which we'd been doing environmentalism, the way in which we'd been doing journalism, the way in which we'd been, even, you know, as writers and artists, trying to meet or not meet the trouble that the world is in. I saw people feeling the same need that we had kind of found and met in each other for not being alone with the sense of trouble, not being alone with the darkness or despair or uncertainty or doubt or whatever it was you were feeling. And then more than that, for a space where it was okay to put that into words, where that wasn't regarded as letting the side down, as kind of giving up, where it was possible to voice those things without there being a rush to action or to answers. Because if there's a rush, then you haven't allowed the thing that's been voiced to change you. And for a lot of the people who I worked with and who were drawn into the, you know, the spaces that we were making with Dark Mountain, it felt like it became a journey to the far side of despair, that there was this acknowledgement of, you know, sometimes you need to give up. Because until you've given up, I mean, it's a bit like what was happening to me, I guess, with that experience in Sheffield Cathedral. Until you've let go, you don't know what's going to be left on the far side of that letting go. You have to be willing to stop saying things that have stopped making sense to you because you feel like you ought to be saying them. And see what's left in that space of emptiness. And again, what people articulated to us in the early years with Dark Mountain, you know, obviously there was a bunch of people who just kind of bounced off the side of it or got kind of angry at it or whatever, but people who were drawn to it articulated a strange sense of hope and of kind of coming alive and of relief at stepping into a space where it was okay to talk about, you know, these things, okay to stop, to let go of that bargaining attitude to, you know, the trouble that we're in, to let go of the need to know how the story ends or to pretend that we and people like us can, you know, be the source of agency that's going to make all of the difference in the story. And I remember somebody at one of the early Dark Mountain festivals, I can think of who it was, in a session on a Sunday morning, saying in this kind of embarrassed voice, "This is the closest thing I have to church." That there was some sense that out of that fellowship of people who had been drawn from different directions by a response to the things that Paul and I and others were writing and publishing in the Dark Mountain books, had come something that let in whatever that other is, that sacred. And you can hear me sort of avoiding putting words to it, whether they're words that come from the tradition I grew up in or other people's traditions, but you can translate it as well. And that, you know, I remember there was one guy, this old guy who kind of came down from the hills in Wales, who had basically been there since the early 70s. He'd been part of the counterculture in the 60s and 70s, and he sort of retreated to the hills as the tide went out in there. And he said, "I always knew it was going to come back one day," he said to me at this Dark Mountain Festival. I was like, wow, well, you know, there is, you will find more debauchery, more kind of the things we might associate with 60s counterculture, more violation of taboos in that way on any high street in Britain on a Saturday night than you would find at these rather tame festivals that we were holding. But there was some other kind of taboo And you know this thing that in the anthropology of taboos, a taboo isn't simply a legal prohibition in a modern legal sense. It's a thing that's not allowed under ordinary circumstances, but can be allowed or even required under sacred circumstances. And so I began to think that there's almost a kind of reverse engineering process where if there is a great taboo against expressing powerlessness, fear, doubt, despair, like there's a great cultural pressure, not least in activist culture, towards a kind of articulation of we can do it, an articulation of optimism, of expectation, then by creating a space where people could show up with their doubts and their fears and put them into words and that be okay, almost like we'd reversed engineered the logic of taboo and this sense of the sacred kind of came into the space. And it doesn't surprise me that a lot of people's journeys on from that have led into a more explicit encounter with an embrace of religion in one form or another. It seems like the thing that you're saying, it seems like we can end up getting alongside each other and discovering that we were already a lot closer in what we were experiencing and articulating and, you know, trying to make space for than we might have realized.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, as you know, I'm certainly seeing a very strong uptick in interest to talk about spirituality more generally and Christianity in particular, primarily from my friends who were very positive about the future or about our ability to, you know, save us and are now less so. I had an idea I wanted to test on you, and it relates to a previous interview I did with Oliver Berkman, who's written this book, 4,000 Weeks About Time. And we had this lovely conversation about surrender. And his book seems to me to be basically surrender to being a human, like surrender to your limits, surrender to finiteness and fragility. And we were talking about the instinct in us that tries to quieten that voice, right? That says, no, you can do it. You can do everything. Just more time management, more hacks, more tech, more science, more progress. And I named for the first time this thought that I'm having because I'm trying to write about what pride is, that it might be that that's what pride is. The bit of us that doesn't want to be a human, that wants to be more than a human. And as you were writing about modernity, and it's really, the book is really, you know, I remember you talking about it as like not wanting to talk about climate change anymore because it leads us into these technocratic solutionism, basically panic and bargaining paths, but instead wanting to talk about the bigger posture that has led us to the trouble that we're in, that you call modernity and Paul Kingsnorth calls the machine and people have had other words for. And I think I might just call pride. Societal pride, our desire for control, use this metaphor of a fish tank, you know, this incredibly detailed, labor and energy intensive attempt to keep fish alive in a fish tank that science can do and we can do, but a lake or a pond does naturally and with ease. And we're wanting to make the whole world into a fish tank when really we should just receive the gift of the lake and the pond and try not to mess it up too much. How does that language of pride sit with you as a lens on modernity? And however it does, could you just unpack a little bit more what you mean by that, about the big path?
Yeah, I mean, the question that I ask early on in the book is, how did we find ourselves in this trouble? And I'm talking at that point primarily about climate change, but I'm saying, you know, climate change asks us questions that climate science cannot answer. And I say that having sat in a lot of rooms with climate scientists over the years and become friends with some of them. And I say it partly as a gift to them to, you know, to let them off the hook of what's being asked, which is that they do all the work of knowing the trouble we're in and telling us what to do about it, which is more weight than it's fair to put on the shoulders of science. But so how did we find ourselves in this trouble? Are we here as a consequence of a piece of bad luck with the atmospheric chemistry, that it turns out sort of seven generations down the line from the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, that all of this CO2 we're throwing out is destabilizing the benign climate conditions of the Holocene? Or did we find ourselves here as a consequence of a way of approaching the world, a way of seeing and treating everyone and everything that would always have brought us to such a pass, even if the atmospheric chemistry had been different? And I mean, it's sort of pretty clear from the way I'm talking which way I answer that question. But the point that I'm making with it is that one way or another, we have to, like any response to climate change is going to imply an answer to that question. And depending on which way we answer it, we're actually going to respond quite differently. Because if we think it's all about a piece of bad luck with the chemistry, then our answer is going to be all about techno fixes and, you know, trying to just find ways of correcting so that we can continue on a sustainable version of the way we were doing things before we realized that this stuff was getting us into trouble. Whereas if we're here as a result of a way of approaching the world, then that has to push us towards a deeper inquiry. And it takes us into the kind of territory that Paul and you and I are all talking about, you know, approaching it with different languages, but with a lot in common, I think, in the way that we're trying to describe it. And I was very struck recently by an Islamic philosopher, Muhammad Amr Mezian, who's talking about this. And he says, you know, this thing that we often end up calling the Anthropocene, this new geological epoch that is the consequence of certain kinds of human activity changing the planet. It's like, I think maybe we should be talking about it as the secularocene, that actually the sort of deep root, the place where we began to get into this trouble was that in Western Europe at a certain point, historically, something strange happened in the way we talked about and related to the sacred. And Muhammad's way of saying this is, he says, you know, heaven didn't go away. It got relocated. So modernity sort of changed the address of heaven from, you know, somewhere beyond, somewhere other, somewhere, you know, up there or under the surface of ordinary reality, and relocated it to the future if we work hard enough. And so it became this project of trying to realize, trying to immanentize the eschaton, trying to realize total freedom and total security on Earth in a material way, secured by human endeavors. And then he came out with this amazing line, and he said, you know, the Earth never asked to bear the weight of being heaven. And so in his telling of it, you know, this trouble that we're in is a consequence of, you know, trying to build heaven on Earth without asking the Earth, you know, without ever reckoning with, you know, whether the Earth could take on that weight. And I found myself talking about this on stage with Alistair McIntosh and Caroline Ross and friends in Govan when I just started the book tour for At Work in the Ruins. And I heard myself saying, if this is the case, then part of what is at stake, you know, part of the work that's called for, is going to involve renegotiating the relationship between heaven and earth. And you know, this is the way that you hear me as well getting drawn into when we get deep down into the roots of, you know, how did we find ourselves here? What way of approaching the world is it that has brought us to this pass? I think we do get called back, you know, not least those of us who in one way or another are kind of coming out of a Christian heritage, out of a Western European heritage. It's a bit like you get lost. You're on a walk in the woods and you get lost. It's not a foolish thing to do, to turn back and retrace your steps. And I feel like to retrace our steps, to reckon with, you know, what changed in the ways that we talked about the sacred, what changed in the ways we thought about, understood heaven and earth and what's worth doing. I think at the end of the book, I have this sort of scene of a campfire off to the side of the big path, which is the big path is my metaphor for, you know, the machine future, the kind of the default trajectory. And I'm kind of imagining scientists and non-scientists sharing stories around that campfire. But I think it's also the case that, you know, I find increasingly environmentalists and theologians and, you know, community activists and songwriters kind of gathering around that campfire and sharing stories and retracing our paths of how we found ourselves here and what language and what ways of being in the world are called for now is part of where I'm ending up.
So what next question that comes when you've done the other stages of the grief and the bargaining and the denial does feel sort of weirdly generative and hopeful. And the thing that your book has really helped me kind of crystallize my language about is, yes, but what kind of people are needed in a time of endings at the end of the world as we know it? But also, what does it mean to be a grown-up? And the sense that what modernity has done is basically made us helpless and educated us into imbecility is really staying with me. You know, if I look at even my grandparents, someone who knew how to build things, someone who knew how to nurse people, someone who knew how to provide food, and someone who knew how to grow food, and someone who knew how to make that food nutritious and available to people. My generation, we can build an app, can make a podcast, but I don't know how the sound gets from us to the people listening to it. You know, the hard skills that our communities are going to need in times of crisis suddenly feel like this urgent sense to reclaim them. You know, I'm going from this podcast to tend my seeds because I want to be someone who can grow enough food. And what is actually worth doing with a life that you asked at the beginning, in my tradition, what is worth doing with a life is loving God and loving your neighbor. And I'd love to just end on that question. If we are, as you suspect, going into a time of more turbulence and more trouble and more endings and modernity beginning to break down, which will bring great danger and also possibly some gifts, what might it look like to love our neighbor in the next season? What might it look like to become the kind of people that might be needed for the season that we're in?
I think it might look like recovering both the kind of skills that were taken for granted by people who, seen through the lens of modernity, were uneducated. You know, I've been listening to John Moriarty, the Irish philosopher and mystic who Martin Shore has been bringing to people's attention. And he was talking about the world he grew up in rural Ireland in the early 20th century and, you know, how if all the grown-ups had disappeared overnight, you know, the 14-year-olds would have been capable. It was not just that society was, you know, capable of feeding itself and meeting its own needs, but that, you know, everyone by the time they were in their teens was capable of, you know, knew how to do all of these tasks. And these people were viewed as ignorant from the perspective of the schooling. So on the one hand, there's the recovery of that, but then what loving the neighbor brings to mind is that alongside that, and maybe helping us not to get overwhelmed and panicked by that, is returning from the models of agency, the ideas of what it takes to be able to act that modernity has infused us with, and that I think are still shaping the dominant responses to something like climate change. It's like that model of agency is, you know, firstly, we have to know the world as if we are what we imagine it would be like to be God knowing the world. Like, step one, omniscience. And then from there, we can act as if we're omnipotent. And so that's where, you know, the plans and schemes and designs and song come in. And so to recover from that, to return to acting is not coming up with a plan for saving the world. It's not getting the right group of people in a room together and coming up with how we're going to fix this, because it's unfixable at that level. Acting is, you know, coming home to where I find myself, the limits of a body, the limits of the particular place and the particular skills and lack of skills that I have, and asking, where do I go from here? What can I do once I start noticing and paying attention to the situation around me? And asking that, the what is to be done question at that level of, what can I do with those who I find myself with? How can I find others with whom to do something, rather than what needs to be done if only everyone would listen to me and follow the plan that I'm laying out in my book for how we get out of this trouble? Because if we're going to find paths through this trouble and find ways of finding the gifts that are there in the hard times that are around and ahead of us, it's not going to look like everyone listening to one person or one committee or one party or whatever it is. It's going to look like people finding ways of being humbled by realizing our ignorance, getting our hands dirty in the work of trying to meet the needs of those around us and trying to recover these capacities for coming together and being human together, guided by logics other than the power of money or the power of the state. And I see people stumbling into that, finding ways of keeping that alive or rediscovering it in pockets already, partly in response to how much trouble is already here, even within our societies that are relatively sheltered from the extent of the trouble that something like climate change represents. And we don't have to know how the story ends. That's not our job. It's our job is just to find a part to play within it and try and keep the story going.
Yeah. You gave me a phrase for something that has shown up a lot in my spiritual life, kind of outside this context, where it's always felt like there's a binary of the kind of theological version of the machine or modernity, which I think is the prosperity gospel. It's like, if I work hard enough, if I pray hard enough, if I am good enough, everything will go okay. It's like control. And there's a deep hubris in that. And a kind of passive, cynical, disengaged withdrawal when, as it turns out, not we are not in control and we don't fully understand what is the action of God in the world, in my language. The kind of like, well, fuck it. What's the point? I'll just do the Solomon thing of, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That this incredibly narrow way, this narrow path, is the path of engaged surrender. Surrendering what is not in our hands, surrendering to what we do not know, and then seeing what is still in our hands and how can we use it for the good of others. That resisting the temptation to panic and withdraw and attack, and continually engage surrender, love your neighbor, engage surrender, love your neighbor. So I wanted to say thank you for the thinking that you've been doing and the way you've been articulating it. Dugald Hine, thank you so much for joining me on The Sacred.
Thank you.
I have listened back to that conversation with Dugald, and there is clearly just a lot in there. We covered a lot of ground about modernity, about this system / kind of cultural liturgy / controlling narrative in which many of us have in the West, and I think we need to be clear that this is not a kind of global unified experience, but that many of us in the West, it's been the air that we breathe and the water that we swim in, and what that might mean and what might be changing. But we started where we always start, with what is sacred. And Dugald really said what's sacred is the place beyond, what is beyond us, what is beyond this world. But that it acknowledged that that's really, really difficult to talk about, because it's where words start to fall apart. You know, words are part of us and this world. And it's almost like they don't travel. They don't translate. And I've experienced that. And it kind of reminded me that I'm often asking about the question, what is sacred to you? Is it the right question? Because it's so hard to answer. And long-term listeners will know that it's very rare that people's guests answer that question is the most interesting thing they say, even though I think it's maybe the most interesting question, because it is so difficult to get to that depth and to that understanding of ourselves, particularly first off the bat. So I thought about moving it to the end. I thought about changing the question. I'd be really interested in what listeners think. But it became quite meta. You know, what is sacred to you? What is sacred to me is the thing that you can't say, you know, that goes beyond our ability to put it into language. Hearing a bit about his story was really helpful. And I think Dugald is so characteristic of many of his generation. And we're probably kind of half a generation apart, maybe, you know, same ballpark, that our generation, many of them, I didn't really, but many of them, many of you had parents who were Christians, even maybe very strong Christians like Dugald, for whom it did shape their whole life. But that inheritance just kind of failed to pass. It itself didn't translate down to a new world. And Dugald speaks, I think, yeah, really, will speak for a lot of people's experience of just feeling the need to let it go. Of this great line about, you know, feeling like a joke, listening to a joke that's been told so many times that we've forgotten that this bit is supposed to be a punchline. It's that strange thing with ideas, isn't it? The power of repetition to form us, but also the power of repetition to kind of dull things and to hide things from us and to cover things over with a film of dust. So perhaps their original radical intent is lost to us. I think it's one of the callings of writers and artists, actually, and maybe preachers or teachers in different areas, is to help us see hidden underneath the dust what is really there. And the thing that comes through speaking to Dugald is just how much he has sat with the realization that many of us are coming to for about 20 years. You know, the Dark Mountain Project has been around a long time now, and it was a space where those people who had been kind of thrown themselves at the environmental movement and come to the end of themselves and gone, one, no one's listening, two, even if they do listen, sort of, how are we going to turn the ship around? We seem to have set up systems that make that impossible. We seem to have set up incentives that make that impossible, have come to that sense of helplessness that many, but not all of us, have had around what are we doing and how do we change the grief. And so I've just had a lot longer than many people, I think, to process that sense of what he calls kind of being alive at a time of endings, of the future not working anymore. And it is so, and I know Dugald a bit, he's a friend, and it is so soothing to sit with someone who is not asking you to be in denial about the level of challenge. And I know that we've always thought it might be the end of the world, and you know, every generation thinks it is. And those of you who lived through world wars or, you know, cold wars or missile crises may be feeling way more sanguine about all this. And I want to learn from you too. But to sit with someone who has done what seems like the sort of, whatever it is, four or five stages of grief, and is saying there is something on the other side of grief, there is something on the other side of despair, and it part of it for him is this letting go of an extractive and controlling posture to the natural world, and maybe to ourselves and to each other also. This kind of high level of faith in human ability to fix things, and too much faith, he thinks, in science, not because he thinks the conclusions of science are wrong, but because he thinks there's too much weight for science, and particularly climate scientists, to bear, to be both the people witnessing and sounding the alarm and being asked to fix it and to say, how did we get here? It's just too much for them. And so that call that there might be other vocations in this time of endings, to help tell stories, to call people to what is actually of use, I have found tremendously hopeful, actually. And I found beginning to think of that, okay, I have been made helpless by modernity. You know, my food is, I don't know where my food comes from. I can't build anything. I can't make anything with my hands. I'm a really good cook, so that's, you know, how do I do more than that? But this call to grow up in the ways that our ancestors grow up, to grow up in the ways that our previous generations did, and just be some practical use as ways to look after ourselves and to love our neighbours. And the thing that comes out when he mentioned the community building in Hernhill Village Market was really the sense of one of the ways we might be able to love our neighbours into more turbulent times is literally to love our neighbours. And yes, some people are going to be called to continue to work on technological mitigation for climate change. And if you're listening to this and thinking Dougal thinks that's pointless, I don't think he does, and I don't. Please keep going. And some of them are going to continue to be called to activism directly around climate change. But I think for a lot of us who haven't known how to found our place in that, realizing that building up links in your local community is as much of a contribution, because with adverse weather events or with other emergencies, social bonds, social capital is what get communities through. People who know each other and help each other endure. And it makes us happier anyway. It makes us healthier anyway. It is a good thing to do in and of itself. But it is also a way we can contribute to the world that is coming. It might be, you know, in our little micro community, we're talking about learning practical skills, about learning to grow food, about working out what might our neighbours need. How could we be the kind of people that would be able to be a blessing and not a drain on those around us? And beginning to think of those things does feel sort of hopeful to me, because it's not as if the high comfort, high convenience, high speed, high tech world that we have inhabited has created a straight line to contentment. I think we could all, you know, unreservedly say that advances in medicine have been the most extraordinary blessing. The drop in child mortality has been an extraordinary blessing. But many of the other so-called advances that our societies have been through have been certainly mixed blessings. And Dougal has helped me narrate that a time of change, probably not the end of the world, but certainly the end of the world as we know it, will come with great losses that we need to grieve, but it also might come with great gifts. And being attuned to that is the message that I was left with, as well as, of course, this theme that has been very present in this series of surrender, to what we don't know, of surrender to what we can't control. Dougal doesn't say the future is going to be some kind of post-apocalyptic wasteland. He says the future is not yet imaginable by us. We don't know. We have to surrender to the mystery and work out what work we can do now to be of use. Thank you for listening. That was a dense, but I hope valuable episode. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and you have been listening to The Sacred with Dougal Hine, and you can get hold of his book At Work in the Ruins at any major retailer. Our production team are Daniel Turner, Lizzie Harvey, and Drew Hawley, and our music is by Luke Stanley with vocals by Lizzie Harvey. The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos, and you can find out more about our work at theosthinktank.co.uk. As always, please do share, rate, review the podcast. It is free to you. There are no ads, and it is one of the ways that if this project is a blessing, you can bless us back. Speak to you next time.